Today on Straight Talk Africa, the International Criminal Court drops charges against alleged perpetrators of the 2007 post-election violence in Kenya. So, what happened to justice for the victims of the Kenyan poll? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios in Washington. It's Wednesday, April 13th. I am Shaka Sali.
Happy Wednesday, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ian Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll talk about the International Criminal Court and the fate of the 2007 victims of the post-election violence in Kenya.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, our audience has weighed in on our topic through your emails and Facebook comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
The International Criminal Court has thrown out the cases against the Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto and the journalist Joshua Arap Sang. They faced allegations of involvement in the 2007 post-election violence. My colleague Esther Githui Ewart has more on the story.
It was a grueling 6 years for William Ruto and Joshua Arap Sang. On December 15, 2010, former ICC prosecutor Moreno Campo asked the ICC to issue summonses against six Kenyans for alleged crimes committed during the 2007-2008 post-election violence. More than 1,000 people died, over 3,500 were injured, and more than 600,000 were displaced. When Ocampo retired, the cases were handed over to current ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda. Charges against four of the accused that included President Uhuru Kenyatta were terminated. After years of back-and-forth travel between Kenya and The Hague, the court finally terminated the case against the last two. ICC spokesman Fadi El Abdallah read the much-awaited court decision.
By majority, with Judge Herrera Karabucha dissenting, that the case against William Samuel Ruto and Joshua Arap Sang is to be terminated.
For Deputy President William Ruto and journalist Joshua Sang, their families and supporters, it was jubilation. In Ruto's rural town of Eldoret, street celebrations broke out.
The case against me and Joshua Sang collapsed and was terminated. The only reason why the case collapsed is because we are innocent.
There were mixed reactions, however, following the termination of the case from lawyers and human rights activists. ICC representative and victims' lawyer Wilfred Nderito said it was a disappointment to the victims of violence, but the decision must be respected.
It's a decision that we must respect. There is no doubt that it will come as a disappointment to victims.
Tom Maliti, a trial monitor at International Justice Monitor, also expressed concern for the victims of the post-election violence.
This decision is obviously disappointing to victims. The fact that it has reached this stage means that for victims, there's very little else left for them.
ICC charges against six Kenyans shook the country. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta's case was dropped in 2014, and the country has put up a spirited fight to get out of ICC membership and vigorously persuaded other African Union members to pull out of the ICC. Some AU members have backed Kenya in this quest, saying the court unfairly targets Africans. Among other ICC high-profile cases involving Africans is that of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo and his wife Simone Gbagbo. In July 2008, the ICC issued an arrest warrant for the Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir for crimes committed against humanity in the country's Darfur region. The Democratic Republic of Congo also had several rebel leaders face criminal charges at the ICC, among them Jean-Pierre Bemba, Bosco Ntaganda, Jermaine Katanga, and Thomas Lubanga. Uganda's rebel Dominic Ongwen is facing charges at the ICC. On Monday, members of the AU Open-Ended Ministerial Committee on ICC agreed the ICC statute should be amended to give immunity to sitting heads of state and senior government officials. The AU statement said the meeting unanimously resolved that the journey for reforming the ICC mode of operation was not over until African countries regained their dignity, independence, and sovereignty. About one-third of the court's member states are in Africa. The key question, however, remains, who will bring justice to Africa's victims of conflict? Does the continent have a solid system of justice? Esther Githu-Ewart, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Esther, for that report. Joining us live via Skype from The Hague is Dr. Layar Song, head of the Rule of Law Program at the Hague Institute for Global Justice and a visiting professor at the Raoul Wallenberg Institute for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in Lund, Sweden. It's a pleasure having you on the program, Mr. Song.
Thanks for having me on your show.
You're most welcome. Talk to me about the case that, of course, was dropped last week. I recall that the first ICC prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, saying that his case against the Kenyans was a watertight. It was watertight. It was, in fact, like, kind of like open and shut. What happened?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. First of all, prosecutors have to be careful with their words. The open and shut cases are rare and far and few between. But it's particularly in this kind of case, we're dealing with something that's very serious. But I want to distinguish right away between ordinary crimes, such as, which are very serious. It could be murder, rape, assault, etc., and crimes such as, the crimes against humanity that were charged in these cases. And the complicating factor, first of all, while they may be the same kinds of crimes, murder that constitute crimes against humanity on the one hand, and just ordinary murder, the difference is that in the case of crimes against humanity, we're talking about a scale that the violations are widespread or systematic. And it implies, and the reason they're of international concern rather than of more local concern is because it implies that there's an organizational element, and that the risk in future, if these things are not prosecuted internationally, it's quite possible that at the domestic level, these things are not being taken care of. So we're talking about a scale or perhaps an involvement of the state authorities or militia that is an organizational element. And that brings us right to the point of what the difficulty in this case, in these cases were. And that is that it was alleged that there was a network which was organized and to carry out, murder, rape, and deportation, persecution on for political reasons following the 2007 elections, and what kind of things would show that? Well, if some people leave in advance the area, they may have had foreknowledge. If there is communications between key organizers, the alleged key organizers, if there are fuel and supplies and vehicles, if groups of people come together shortly before the violations. These are all indications, and there are other things one can think of, that show an organizational plan. And what makes it so serious is that if we are talking about crimes against humanity, then often these things are not able to be addressed competently by the domestic authorities because they're too serious, and the domestic authorities, the courts, the prosecution, may be under the influence of state authorities in some way. So open and shut case, there are two difficulties here. One is to prove the network existed, really, and this was not just spontaneous violations, and to link the suspects to the violations. It was not alleged that Kenyatta in the past and Ruto and Sang you know, went around wielding knives themselves, etc. What's alleged is that they were in an organizational capacity in some way. Now, to prove that is more of a challenge than when you're dealing with single instances of murder. So you have there's a little doubt that the violations, that the crimes were committed. Hmm. We see that in the victims. But the responsibility for that and the organizational planning element, command and control, if you like, even if it may be outside a military context, but in terms of orders and subordinates, etc., it is not that easy to prove in all cases. So I think this is where the prosecution fell down, and this is where no case to answer motion received the approval from the majority of the court, of the chambers.
If you look at the history of the ICC, you will find that about six cases out of eight cases at The Hague were referred there by governments. And in situations where governments have cooperated, you have been able to see some movement. Would it be fair to say that in order for the ICC to succeed, it needs state cooperation?
Yes. It is very important that, you know, the International Criminal Court, which is limited in resources, it's a fledgling institution. And it has limited personnel, limited resources. In order to collect evidence, in order to get a hold of perpetrators, in order to, you know, conduct investigations, state cooperation is indeed vital. And you have some fortunate situations where there's a change in regime. We see that, in Côte d'Ivoire, and we see that in some other places where there you may see a change in the regime. So, or hopefully that there can be some possibilities. Or even if there's not a change in the regime, that the one that is accused of complicity, you may have dissenting elements in government or people willing to talk, etc. In any case, it's very difficult to conduct investigations, or in any rate, more difficult when you can't gain access to the territory, where security conditions are weak. For example, well, Syria is not an international criminal court case, but trying to investigate violations in Syria, for example, is very difficult. So state cooperation is indeed very important, which raises a difficult catch-22 or conundrum, if you like, which is that in situations where you most need international criminal justice, it's most difficult to make it work, and it's most easy to work where probably the state is more cooperative. But where the state is cooperative, normally it will prosecute and punish perpetrators on its own. So there is a problem there, and it's not an easy one to solve. But you know, this is not necessarily an absolute stumbling block, but it is a very important difficulty you've hit on, which is correct.
Earlier, we heard in a soundbite from Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto that the case has collapsed because he and his colleagues are innocent. Are they innocent?
It's not for me to say whether they are innocent or guilty. What is important that I can affirm is that international criminal justice, as all criminal justice does and should do, is give proper weight to the legal presumption of innocence. And there cannot be a fair trial unless, the prosecution proves its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And the burden never shifts to the accused to disprove his or her guilt. It is always on the prosecution to prove his or her guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's the way it should be. If any of us, are accused unjustly, and it can happen, we want to know that there's a high burden on the prosecution. So, the prosecution has to do its homework, and I know there have been allegations, and that it's come up to the court of witness tampering, of corruption, of bribery of witnesses, and of intimidation. Possibly some deaths involved here or there, and of witnesses. These are very serious allegations, and these things are not to be taken lightly. But neither is the presumption of innocence, which is a very, very key element of the right to fair trial, which has to be respected. I'm glad to see that the judges do uphold that. That's absolutely essential.
Well, on that note, Dr. Sang, thank you very much for your analysis.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. And now we'll pause for a short break. Would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website Twitter, and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka, that's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag at VOA ICC Africa Leaders. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. Become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111, U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui Ewart, and welcome back. Now joining us here in our Washington studios are two distinguished guests. Dr. Kenneth Mwenda, a professor at American University, Washington College of Law, and Dr. Nyaka Lagoke, founder of the Revival of Pan-Africanism Forum. Well, I have to say, gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
You're most welcome, Sean.
Good. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, too. And joining us via telephone link-up from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, is Sylvia Chebet, a senior reporter at Citizens Television, our affiliate station in Kenya. Thank you very much for joining us, Sylvia. Sylvia, thank you very much. Can you hear me? Well, later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111. Yes, country code is 1. Let me come to you immediately, Kenneth. You listened, of course, to your fellow panelist, Dr. Sang. Do you agree with most of the things that he said, or would you like to contradict him somewhere?
No, I actually agree with a lot of what my colleague has said. The ICC, if you look at the Rome Treaty, proceeds on the basis of general principles of international criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, the ICC statute, the Rome Treaty itself, is a codification of much of customary international law, where you're dealing with crimes which are covered mainly by what we call universal jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
The other underlying concept in international law for the ICC treaty is what we call the principle of complementarity. The ICC can only proceed on the basis that there is complementarity with municipal courts in the domestic jurisdictions. For example, if a crime cannot be prosecuted within the domestic or what you call under municipal law, because it involves issues of state immunity and so forth, you can then elevate that to a higher level, which is at the international level, the ICC. And that will be for parties that are state signatories and have ratified the treaty. But even then, countries such as the US, which did sign the treaty but did not ratify, they should not take any actions which should go against the spirit and intendment of the treaty, because they're signatories. The fact that you have not ratified does not mean you can just ignore the spirit of the treaty. You have to respect that. So I fully agree with my colleague. He was on firm ground. I mean, he spoke about issues of presumption of innocence. These are fundamental principles in any democratic society. And quite right, the burden of proof is always on the prosecution. And the standard of proof in these type of cases is pretty high, unlike in civil procedure or civil litigation. In criminal litigation, the standard of proof is very high, beyond reasonable doubt.
Very interesting. Now, this particular case against the Kenyans, for example,
right,
have these charges been dropped because they are innocent, as Kenyan Deputy President Ruto indicated, or, in fact, is this a vacation of the charges?
Well, first and foremost, like my colleague pointed out, the burden of proof is on the prosecution to prove that. We cannot speak for the ICC. It would be unfair. And neither can we speak for the accused persons whose charges are now dropped. Again, it would be unfair. There could be some evidence there that wasn't gathered. We should look at resources that are available to the ICC to do the investigation and so forth.
Mm.
I think there's an issue of limited resources available to the ICC, number one. Number two, there's also the issue of limited political will from a lot of states to support and to collaborate in the investigative processes. So these are some of the issues which militate against the effectiveness of the court. But I think later on also in the program, I will talk about the need perhaps to cast the net much wider in the type of cases, the indictments that come before the court. It should give no excuse whatsoever to exonerate or avoid prosecuting African leaders. They should be prosecuted. But in addition to that, we should cast the net wider to other parts of the world, Europe, North America, South Asia. We should. So far, the only non-African indictment brought before the court is from Georgia, and that was very recent.
Mm.
The rest of them are from Africa.
Very interesting. Nyako, of course, the Pan-Africanist himself, talk to us about the perception, for example, that the ICC targets Africa, really. And the last time I checked, the ICC is made up of about two-thirds. I think a third, actually, of the ICC membership is from Africa. And these leaders who signed the Rome Statute did not sign it under intimidation. They were not signing it because somebody had an AK-47 pointed at them. What happened?
It's a difficult question because I believe that when people talk about the ICC, I just came from Ghana. There was a conference well organized by the Gimpa Institute about ICC in Africa. There was another one I attended at The Hague about ICC in Africa. And those who want to support the ICC want to present the situation such a way that what people say about the ICC is not the reality, but it is a perception. And then when we look at the facts upon which people base their point of view, the facts are against the ICC, like you said, and then and Kenneth just said it, most of the cases that they're prosecuting are African cases. So then people who think that the ICC is targeting Africans, you know, they're justified in their assertion. But one thing I would like to add is that there are some people, and they're not black, and they wrote some books. There is a white French citizen, her name is Stephanie Maupass, who wrote a book, and the title of the book is that the ICC is a tool in the hands of the most powerful. And there is another one, Dr. David Hoyle, who published a book, a 600-page book, to demonstrate that the ICC is a broken institution. So it means that there are some justice lovers and then freedom seekers in the world, black and white, who believe that the ICC is conducting its business in a very partial way, and then be in Kenya or be in Ivory Coast in different parts where the ICC is conducting its business, we see a selective prosecution which leads to a selective investigation, certainly to lead to, you know, to end with a selective justice, which is not true justice.
We'll come to more on that, of course, later. Let me go to Nairobi. Good evening, Sylvia. Are you there?
Good evening.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Talk to us about the mood on the ground. What are people talking about, especially in view of what happened last week? After all, the Kenyan alleged perpetrators of the 2007 post-election violence are off the hook.
Yeah, as you can imagine, Deputy President William Ruto and his co-accused Joshua Sang were elated about the verdict, and the excitement was equal, if not more, in their home grounds. They both come from Rift Valley, but not quite the same for victims. They were disappointed. Remember, the local mechanism had borne no fruit. The cases against the so-called Ocampo Six, as they were called, had all collapsed. This was really their last chance, or the last. They were hoping that through this case, somebody would be held accountable for the violence that caused them so much harm, deaths, and also loss of property, and their relocation to other places they never knew was home before. But the verdict itself, as you can imagine, had the potential to polarize the country, and the opposition led by Raila Odinga then chose to issue congratulatory messages to Ruto and Sang, although Mr. Odinga's sentiments today, if you may have heard, might change things completely, at least politically speaking, because he told AFP in France today that the decision spelled doom for the international justice system and a fight against impunity, and that it's unlikely that the ICC would be a deterrent to any other African leader, because according to him, African leaders was, and every other leader for that matter, was supposed to fear the ICC, that it would hold them accountable for any atrocity that they might visit or cause to their civilian population. And if I can, you know, take you back to last week, for journalists, it was really an anxious day that day, because no one knew which way the ruling would go, not even the defense counsels. I did speak to the deputy president's lead counsel that day, Karim Khan, and he told me that they had pleaded with the court to allow them to have that verdict in advance, even if it was just for two hours ahead of everyone. But they were not granted that luxury. So they also had to keep refreshing their emails just as we did. And, you know, journalists had to even prepare two scripts, you know, anticipating a ruling that would be that would go either way. Yeah.
Now, give us an update on the victims. Have they all been resettled, or do you still have some in internally displaced camps?
Well, there has been programs that the government has been running, the resettlement programs. Those programs, I think, have basically been concluded, because all the victims that were in camps that immediately after the violence, there were several camps that, you know, came up. And from those camps, the government tried to have everybody resettled, at least on some pieces of land that were bought by government. They were given some little money just to start them off and even rebuild their homes. But that, according to victims, really is not enough. It does not address the whole justice issue. Nobody has been held accountable for that violence. Yes, they have been resettled, but it's not enough. So for some of them, they lost really everything. And a little something from the government might not really be enough to start them off. It cannot pay for the people who they lost, really.
Finally,
and the bodily harm that it might that they may have suffered.
Finally, Sylvia, how is the Kenyan media covering the story?
Well, at this point, the Kenyan media, of course, is being very cautious about the situation in the country. We do not want to be to again polarize the country because of this. For many Kenyans, this the ruling for many the ruling really should have gone this way, just for the sake of appeasing all sides, because it was seen that crucifying two people for all that violence was unfair. So for at this moment, the media is approaching this thing very cautiously. We do not want to air, you know, sentiments from members of the political class that would be seen to be insightful. And I believe even the political class is being a bit, you know, not cagey, but a bit controlled about their remarks to the public. This week we are expecting, this weekend we are expecting the deputy president and the president to go to a political, to attend a political rally, which they say, or call it a Thanksgiving rally after the verdict. It is the place that they started off. It's the place they cemented their union, and which led or took them to State House, basically. But really, everybody in the country at this moment, at least for the media particularly, there is that sense of awareness that what we report could build or break this country.
Are you surprised that the media is covering the story that way, especially given that part of the media, of course, is owned by the state, and the other is owned by the Kenyan elite, who are very closely associated with the people in charge of the country?
Yeah, that's true indeed, but even then, journalists have, since the violence, several journalists have really undergone trainings, and there is really that consciousness among journalists that they need to be, they need to exercise that gatekeeping role very keenly.
Well, thank you so much, Sylvia Chebet, from Citizens Television, our field station in Kenya. Well, you're tuned into Straight Talk Africa, and we have more of a discussion in a moment, but first here is Ayen Bior. Take it away, Ayen.
Thanks, Shaka. And still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic feedback we received from our audience through social media. But now, here's our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan. Our letter of the week comes from Patricia Nambi, who writes, "The ICC failed to prove that William Ruto planned the violence against humanity in Kenya. Without concrete evidence, one can't be considered guilty. This case was probably based on hearsay, or no witness was bold enough to come out and testify against Mr. Ruto. The ICC should first get concrete evidence before accusing African leaders."
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America. For more information, visit our website at www.voanews.com/African Beat.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. Call us collect and we'll pay for the call. Or call directs and we'll call you right back. Remember to keep your questions brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui-Ewart, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague, and social media reporter, Ayen. Take it away again, Ayen.
Thank you, Shaka. We received tremendous feedback in our STA inbox to this week's question. As we've mentioned, the International Criminal Court dismissed charges against Kenya's deputy president, William Ruto, and a local radio director, Joshua Arap Song, for their alleged roles in the 2007-2008 post-election violence. This leads us to our question of the week, which asked, what do you think about the ICC dismissing charges against Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto? Before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for using all of our social media platforms to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOA ICC Africa Leaders. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. And speaking of, let's go to a tweet from Wako Joel, who tweets, yes, the ICC lacked credible evidence to incriminate William Ruto. Witnesses became coy or may have been silenced. We have another tweet from Emmanuel Kachele, who tweets, dismissal of charges against Ruto is a key to stabilizing Kenyan government, but disappointing to the victims. Now to a comment from Facebook fan Guma Buma Michael from Leuven, Belgium, who writes, the ICC was caught between two hard rocks, faced with threats by most of Africa's quasi-dictators to pull out of its confines. The ICC cowed down, much to the chagrin of those whose relatives were innocently butchered in one of Africa's worst ever post-election violence. Very absurd. Well, Shaka and guests, a very wide range of opinions here. What's your take?
Very interesting. In fact, I might also add, although, of course, someone alluded to it, what, in fact, happens if the African governments pull out of the ICC? Does this mean, for example, Kenneth, that no African leader can, in fact, be accountable to anybody, for that matter?
Thanks, Shaka. First of all, like I pointed out earlier on, the ICC treaty, the Rome Treaty, is a codification of much of customary international that has been going on. Now, there are two fundamental principles in customary international law, what we call state immunity pertaining to head of state. There is, first of all, a personal immunity of a president when he's a sitting president. When he's no longer a sitting president, the immunity does not end. It continues but becomes functional immunity, to the extent that the functions that he performed whilst in office, he cannot be held accountable for that. Now, the concept of state immunity does not sit by itself and is not absolute. In international law, there's what is known as ego omens, obligations of states, and jus cogens. Now, jus cogens, these are norms from which you cannot derogate. Whether you've got immunity does not mean you can go around with impunity to just break the law. And that's really the thrust of international criminal justice system.
But you can actually do that if you figure out a way of becoming a presidential monarch, or a life president for that matter.
Yeah, but under the Rome Treaty, what the innovation that has come through under the Rome Treaty to depart from customary international is that there is no immunity. Immunity is waived. Whether you're a sitting president or not, you can be prosecuted. That position is not available under customary international. It's an innovation under treaty law, the Rome Treaty. Therefore, a sitting president can be prosecuted. Even worse, for example, in the case of Kenya, if you look at the Kenyan constitution, the vice president of Kenya does not enjoy immunity. It's the president who enjoys immunity. So he can be prosecuted even in Kenya itself if there is sufficient evidence. Now, the question is, what will happen if these guys, you know, African governments were to pull out? It's not only African government, including Europeans' government. Under universal jurisdiction, you can prosecute certain crimes, for example, slavery, war crimes. Whoever committed a crime anywhere in the world can be prosecuted in any country whatsoever, regardless of where the crime was. For example, he's an American, he can be prosecuted in Kenya, Nairobi, for war crimes under international customary law. There is provision for that.
There is provision for that.
Under customary international
law. Of course, that the Americans have Article 98.
There have been a lot of scholars, pundits, who've argued against the concept of universal jurisdiction, but even these arguments are not very persuasive. It's well-established and trite reasoning in customary in international law that the concept of universal jurisdiction entitles every state whatsoever to prosecute for those fundamental crimes which are committed by anybody anywhere in the world.
Very interesting. Ayin, what more do you have? What more reaction do you have from the audience, please?
Thank you, Shaka. Let's go to another comment from a Facebook fan, Martin Nyalusi from Tanzania, who writes, I think the ICC ruling is correct, and this shows a way of avoiding and scaling down neo-colonialism Africa should remain as Africa and not puppetism. And our last Facebook comment comes from Tumusegi Julius, who writes, I think the ICC was afraid to tamper with the prevailing peace in Kenya and not that the prosecution had a case. Well, again, Shaka, a couple of interesting points made. Your thoughts?
Very interesting indeed. Nyeka, your reaction?
First of all, I believe that the decision of the ICC, you know, to drop the case in Kenya is an expression of a political defeat, because we know that the ICC, even though the Kenyans themselves, they found a way to try and resolve the issue, the ICC was still adamant to continue to prosecute the president, the vice president, and other defendants in the Kenyan case. Now that the leaders have used the political power in order to rally many in Africa and in the world around the case, and then the ICC did not have any other opportunity but to drop the case. So it's a political defeat for the ICC. Now, like Kenneth said, I believe that this is what I want to see in Kenya, that the President Kenyatta really tries to put together a framework, you know, for internal justice, for an indigenous judicial process, you know, so that, you know, the pain of the victims, you know, can be relieved. So this is what I really believe. And if it does so, then, you know, we have a reason to hope that Africans are mature enough, you know, to deal, you know, with the internal issues, you know, without the interference of the International Criminal Court, which is seen by many, like me, as an instrument of neocolonialism, because it is used by some powers in the West in order to either threaten some leaders or, you know, to have their way in our internal affairs in Africa.
We should point out, by the way, that in the Kenyan particular case, the Kenyan government had, in fact, an option of taking care of that business.
Yeah,
they simply couldn't do it. They decided to send it to The Hague because, according to William Ruto, he thought, in fact, the United Nations would probably take 100 years before it revisits that case, and by then he would be gone. Well, thanks again for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
It's a pleasure, and that does it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. And if you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa. And follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. Or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the app. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now, let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the 2016 World Bank IMF Spring Meetings. Join host Shaka Sali, his panel of guests, and me, Ayen Bior, your social media reporter, as we talk about the World Bank. That's next week on Straight Talk Africa.
Well, welcome back. And today we are, of course, talking about the International Criminal Court and the fate of the 2007 victims of the post-election violence in Kenya. Our distinguished guests are Dr. Kenneth Mwenda, a professor at American University Washington College of Law, and Dr. Nyaka Lagoke, founder of the Revival of Pan-Africanism Forum. Gentlemen, I have again to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Most welcome, sir.
Thank you, sir.
No, you're most welcome. Now, let's talk about, this business of the ICC, which, of course, some people have suggested. In fact, it is more or less the moral equivalent of an imperialist, neo-colonialist tool, is it?
I think the intent of the international community in setting up the ICC was genuine. The intent was good. It's the implementation which has a problem, more what I would call the governance framework. The idea was, let's codify customary international and introduce new principles, of course, like I said. And now under the ICC treaty, a sitting president, you can waive immunity and just proceed and prosecute. There's nothing wrong with that. There are two traditions in the international community. One tradition, what we call monism, and the other one, dualism. There are certain states which say, for example, if we have not signed a treaty, that treaty, or if we've signed and ratified, as long as it has not been incorporated or adopted in our domestic laws, then we cannot be bound by that if a case were to come up in a domestic court of law. Others say once, you know, a treaty is passed or norms of customary international, they automatically apply to us. Okay, that's the monist, which says there's a unitary philosophy of law. Now, what is happening in a lot of these countries, you have a bit of monist dualist. And therefore, we see situations, for example, where, like in the Kenya case, the question is, in Kenyan law, for example, should we extend the argument that because the president is a sitting president, therefore his immunity should extend beyond the Kenyan jurisdiction? Yes, under customary law, that's a genuine argument, but not under the Rome Treaty. Once right. you are signatory to that, you lose that immunity. But I think, like I pointed out earlier on, looking forward, the future for this court is to show genuine concern and to able to throw the hook beyond Africa into other regions. There are a lot of atrocities that have been committed internationally, and we ought to see the prosecutor reach out into those jurisdictions
like
to get...
Iraq?
Precisely.
Afghanistan?
Yeah, precisely. There are a lot
Syria?
Of them, yes. The one caveat, though, I should point out is that under the Rome Treaty, you cannot prosecute retroactively beyond the time when the court was set up.
Beyond
it's
the
crimes
two,
which...
Ha-
exactly. There's a statute of... Sort
below
of,
2002.
Exactly. That, equivalent to a statute of limitation there. So it has to be incidents that occurred after the court was created. But the future of the court, to demonstrate, to gain more legitimacy, you can create an institution through legal means, but it may lack legitimacy if there's not sufficient public approval of this institution.
Very interesting. Now, Nyaka... it really wasn't until the issue of Sudanese president Omar al-Bashir came up, and later the issue of Kenyan president Uhuru Kenyatta, that this ICC became the elephant in the room in Africa, as far as the leaders were concerned. Because for as long as the ICC was taking care of the adversaries or the political enemies of the African leaders, it was okay.
Yeah, because this, the ICC is, you know, I'm going to be brief on that. The ICC is today is being used, you know, by the most powerful and also by some sitting leaders. We know that in the case of Uganda, if you go after Kony, you should be able to go after Museveni, but it's not happening. In the case of Ivory Coast, if you go after Gbagbo, if you go after Blake Goodey and you want Gbagbo's wife, you should be able to go after Mr. Ouattara, you should be able to go after Mr. Soro, you should be able to go after Mrs. Ouattara, but it's not happening. In the case of Ivory Coast, the single most atrocious massacre committed by Mr. Ouattara's forces before the fall of Gbagbo, more than 1,000 people killed. And then the ICC, 5 years after the arrest of Gbagbo, is not even able to even try even one single person from the Ouattara's camp. So Mr. Ouattara used the ICC, you know, to capture Gbagbo, or to put Gbagbo there, and then when it now he notices that the ICC wants to go after him, and it is the truth, now he said that the judicial system in Ivory Coast is now fit enough, you know, to prosecute, you know, crimes against humanity. So this is how the ICC people have been playing with the ICC, and this leads, you know, to the lack of credibility of, you know, that international institution.
Is it wrong, for example, for some people who have suggested that when African leaders say that the ICC targets Africa, it is really because it targets African leaders who are obviously symbols of African sovereignty.
And
is that asking
just
for
give me one
much?
Second. That,
of course.
Because, and then one thing, and I love that question, because this is what I wanted to say when I was coming here. When we talk about sovereignty, it's not just about Africans. If you go from the our contemporary world history from the 19th century, when Gustave Mounier spoke about putting together like an international tribunal after the war between France and Germany in 1870-1871, from that time to today, the concern of the European powers and the reason why many of them do not want to sign the Treaty of Rome is because they're jealous of the sovereignty. So it's a it's part of the nature of nations to be jealous of the sovereignty, and Africans too. So we have the same issue. Now, we notice that in the case of Gbagbo, and even in the case of Kenyatta, or even the case of Bashir, I'm not saying that we may not find crimes against them, but what we see is that when they seem to be moving towards the opposite side, the side that is opposed to the West, then the ICC is instrumentalized by those powers, you know, to so that they can get away. And that's why many, I'm not in power and I'm not associated to any crime, and there are millions of Africans, and we heard some of your guests talking about the fact that we too want our sovereignty, and the ICC is used to undermine our desire to be self-sufficient and to be, you know, to express our sovereignty. That's a true case. Those who support the ICC, they do not want to see it. They think it's a perception. No. There is a new Africa that is being born. And you can see that in Benin, in Burkina Faso, in Senegal. And we want a new Africa. We want our leaders to be accountable, but at the same time, we want to reduce the interference of the West in our domestic affairs. This is a reality in Africa today.
After all, someone might say that the intellectual and media balance of power has been shifting in favor of Africa. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, where the telephone callers would like to ask you a couple of questions. Good evening, Tafa from Ghana. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Hello, good evening, Chaka. How are you doing?
I am hugely terrific, Tafa. How are you today?
I'm very good, Chaka. My greetings to your honorable guests in the studio.
Thank you. Your question, Tafa.
Chaka, I have two quick questions. Chaka, many Africans have a belief, including me, that there's no way President of the United States will pay a visit to somebody that they knew that have some criminal issue on his head. Talking about regard to the Kenya, we all knew that President of the United States has paid a Kenya visit recently, and he met the President of Kenya and the Vice President. So some of us have that belief that if the United States know that Kenya President has some questions to answer to ICC, there's no way the United States President will pay a Kenyan President a visit. Secondly, Chaka, my question that goes to ICC, whatever they are, International Criminal Court. Where is those people who give them the initial information that warrant the investigation? We want to know. Because it was somebody who reported the case to them before they started the investigation. So where are those people? They should go and look for those people. We want to know what happened. The initial information that they have, based on that, they initiate the investigation against the Kenyan President and the Vice President. Chaka, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Let's go to Nigeria. Good evening, Patrick. You're most welcome. Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Mr. Chaka. Good evening, our guest. That's Patrick Okura for in Arochukwu, Nigeria.
Terrific.
Mr. Chaka, you see, let us face reality. ICC job in Kenya was a welcome development. And my question goes to Mr. Nyaka, sir. If ICC did not go to Kenya, do you agree with me that many African leaders could have turned election in their country to be true or tie, true or false? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to Cliff from Uganda. Cliff, you're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Chaka, how are you?
I am hugely terrific, Sam, but you are called Cliff. How are you?
ICC prosecutes all the African cases. What is Bonnier saying? That, wait a minute, their action cases and acts against humanity in Iraq, North America, Syria, Palestine, the participation with Israel, Colombia, and why can't the ICC cover widely the scope of investigation greatly and not to target only African states. Thank you, Shaka, and have a nice time.
You're most welcome. Nyaka, you want to respond to...
Yeah, the question, the first one was about...
The second one from Nigeria.
No, about Kenya, but I could not hear clearly, but I know that, yes, it was difficult. But what I think I've understood is that about Kenya, if, you know, the ICC does not go there, and it may be an opportunity for African leaders, you know, to fraud around the election and then stay in power. But first of all, we have to agree that all of us, if the international tribunal or international jurisdiction can be fair, we agree. We know the UN, you know, so I do not want to go into that, but we can look at the UN, the way it's functioning. So if there is something that is there, you know, that is fair, we will agree. But in the case of Kenya, there are two things that I forgot to say that I'm going to say now. First, if they want to go after Uhuru Kenyatta, or they should have gone also after Kibaki, or they should have gone after Raila Odinga. And that the very Raila Odinga that Sylvia mentioned, we know that the West favored him, and then everything that was put into place under the pressure of the West was to eliminate Uhuru Kenyatta, you know, to give a competitive advantage to Raila Odinga. Unfairness in the case of Kenya, just in the beginning, first thing. Second, we can see, for instance, that we can say, well, you know, we have to go after the U.S. or we have to go after... I don't talk about things, you know, that I cannot master. In that case, it is almost impossible because the Security Council is in the hands of a few and would decide for global politics. So we're not going to dream of America being prosecuted by the International Criminal Court.
But I think we should also, frankly, point out that if that were to happen in the United States of America, the incumbent president would be impeached. In fact, there has been an impeachment when I am here against a sitting president at one time called Bill Clinton, except that he was never indicted. Let's go for it.
Yeah, thank you, Shaka. That's an excellent observation, actually. The U.S. Municipal law, which is domestic law, we call it municipal law, has clearly shown that they've got very effective checks and balances within the legislature, which makes it possible to get a president impeached. In Africa and many developing countries, it's a little bit different. But I think one important policy recommendation going forward, which would really help...
You have 30 seconds.
The ICC is to have a legal mechanism which can actually compel the Security Council to bring certain cases from the West to the ICC. We don't have that leverage. Mm. It simply says the Security Council can bring a case, but under what grounds?
Correct.
The statute can be amended to say somebody can bring a motion to compel the Security Council to move ahead.
And what about others who say that the Africans should set up their own court? But this would be a court that leaders in Africa would control.
It's pretty difficult given the political culture in Africa. I doubt very much that would succeed.
I see. Well, on that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Dr. Kenneth Mwenda, a professor at American University Washington College of Law, and Dr. Nyaka Lagoke, founder of the Revival of Pan-Africanism Forum. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.